Thank you all very much, and it is my distinct pleasure to now open the keynote portion of our luncheon. And it is an honor to introduce our keynote speaker. We are so privileged to be joined today by Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Senator Lee is, in I think my opinion and that of many, one of our nation's foremost advocates for the principles of constitutional government, federalism, originalism, and the role the rule of law plays in securing our liberty. Senator Lee has had an incredible career of service. He grew up in Utah and in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Good training, I think, for his current role, going back and forth. He is a graduate of BYU Law School, and early in his legal career, Senator Lee served as a law clerk to District Judge D. Benson, and then as a law clerk to then Third Circuit Judge Samuel Alito. Senator Lee then had a career as an appellate attorney in private practice and as an assistant United States attorney in Utah. He served as general counsel to Governor Huntsman of Utah, and then clerked again for a judge he had previously clerked for, who by that time had the title Justice Samuel Alito. Now, here I need to interject a personal story. About 11 years ago, I sat on the other side of an interview from a set of law clerks, one of whom was then law clerk Mike Lee. And I was 25 years old and very, very nervous. And Senator Lee and his co-clerks drilled me with hypotheticals on constitutional law for about 45 minutes. Now, a few of you in this room years later had the pleasure of being on the other side of that interview with me and thought that I asked hard questions. But I promise you, they were nothing compared to the questions I received that day from Senator Lee. The only one I can remember was about how the Equal Protection Clause might apply to practices on a U.S. ship in international waters. And as I was fumbling through an answer I was just making up on the spot, I can't remember if it was Senator Lee or one of his co-clerks, but they turned to me with a wry smile and they said, well, what if the ship was full of pirates? And I didn't know what that meant or how it applied to equal protection on the high seas or how equal protection applied on the high seas. But I remember that my answer was incoherent and I completely sweated through my suit. So then, after he clerked for Justice Alito, Senator Lee returned to private practice, where he enjoyed a reputation as a distinguished appellate advocate. In 2010, he ran for and won the Senate seat he now holds. And for the last 6 years, it is no exaggeration to say that Senator Lee has been one of our nation's most important, most eloquent, and most steadfast defenders of liberty and the Constitution. Please join me in welcoming Senator Mike Lee of Utah.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I have to admit that's a little bit alarming. When people stand up like that, I'm not accustomed to that. That does not happen to me in Washington. It's a little alarming, but I'm grateful nonetheless. Happy to be with you today. I'm happy to have my wife Sharon and two of our children with us. I tried to bring them up right by exposing them to good things in life, teaching them about our faith, and bringing them to things like the Federalist Society so that they can learn to be good citizens. So in this respect, the Federalist Society has always been a place where I've felt at home, a place where I've felt comfortable. I actually attended a Federalist Society event while still in high school. As the president of the Teenage Republican Club, we went to our local law school because we found out the Federalist Society was hosting Judge Robert Bork, and we had to come and listen to him speak. So in that sense, the Federalist Society feels like family to me. And it's appropriate that we're gathered here. I mean, this feels sort of like a family dinner in Utah. in a family with infertility problems, of course. But I've been in the Senate now for 6 years, and it seems difficult to comprehend that it's been that long. It seems like only yesterday that I had just gotten elected to the Senate. Seems like only day before yesterday when I was a Senate candidate, and I met another Senate candidate named Marco Rubio in February of 2010. He and I shared something in common. We shared a number of things in common. We were both running for the United States Senate. Nobody expected either one of us to win. We were both young lawyers, and I discovered at the time that we were born exactly 7 days apart. He's older than I am. I just want to make that clear. When I heard him speak, I knew immediately that this is was someone who had a great destiny. While I wasn't sure whether either he or I would win the races that we were involved in at the moment, I knew that he was a gifted statesman and someone with a bright future ahead of him. I still remember, as if it were yesterday, when we both came out for our freshman orientation in the fall of 2010, just after we got elected, and they made us go and get our pictures taken. And we, after getting our pictures taken, were issued official Senate IDs. We were in these, I'm going to show you a picture of this in a moment. We were in these adjacent subway cars underneath the Senate office buildings. And he was in the car behind us. Sharon and I looked over at him. We could see him through the window. We waved. And he just went like this and held up his Senate ID card. Kind of like a 16-year-old who just got his driver's license, wanted to show everybody, hey, I've got game. This is happening for me. I still remember when I got that ID card. I had to use it a lot in the next few months because the security guards in the Capitol didn't recognize me. They didn't think I looked like a senator. I was the youngest senator, 39 years old at the time. I had to try to impress my colleagues by telling them that I could read at the level of a 40-year-old. In a place where the average age is about 160, that, you know, you got to take what you can get. The police didn't recognize me, and I was not used to being carded as a non-drinking kid from Utah. So I had to pull out my ID card all the time, and I even named it after a while. And I'll get to that in a moment, but I had to show them this card to prove who I was. And at the time, you know, it has my name on it. It says United States Senator from Utah, and then it has an expiration date. The card at the time said expiration January 3rd, 2017. And I had to explain to my wife and our three children that that is not the date when I personally will expire. That is instead the date of the expiration of my term of office. I went through this exercise all the time. These cops didn't recognize me, didn't think I looked like a senator, so they would card me and I'd show them the proof that I had a right to be there and then say, okay, you can come on in. And after a while, somebody told me there is a shortcut to this. If you will wear the little pin, the little lapel pin they gave you when you were sworn in, then that won't happen anymore. And I didn't think that was true, but I put it on and it worked like a charm. So I ended up naming the pin because when I wore the pin, if they carded me, I didn't have to show them my card. I'd just point to the pin and they would say, sorry, Senator, you can come on in. So I called it my sorry Senator pin because that's... The sorry Senator pin worked well. It still works well most of the time. Every once in a while, it fails. After I had been in the Senate almost a year, I was on the floor of the Senate in between votes, and I had one arm gently resting in front of my desk like this, and this non-uniformed security guy came up to me and said in a very harsh tone of voice, I would add, excuse me, sir, will you please not lean on the senator's desk? Terribly sorry. Won't happen again. See, I have to tell you something about the Senate. They're really sensitive about the desks. The desks in the Senate are original equipment, which means they're about 165 years old, which means that they're almost as old as some of my colleagues. And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was putting any weight on the desk. It won't happen again. And I said, are you with the minority? And I said, well, what do you mean? I with the Republican conference in the Senate was the minority conference at the time. And I said, well, yes, but do you mean on this vote or the next? I don't always vote with my party. Sometimes they get it wrong. Are you with the minority leader? And I said, well, Mitch McConnell is our minority leader. We hope one day that he will be the majority leader rather than minority leader, but no, are you part of the minority leader's staff? And I realized, oh, he doesn't know who I am. So I just pointed gently to the pen and all it got me was a blank stare. And so, at that point, I realized I was going to have to use my title. Don't like using my title. Didn't like using my title then. Still don't. And so I kind of mumbled it. I said, I'm Senator Lee. And he didn't hear me because I mumbled it. And he said, excuse me? And I said, okay, my name is Mike Lee. I come from a state called Utah. It's sort of squarish. It resembles a chair. We have lovely skiing. It's in the Rocky Mountains. Only then did he realize who I was and what the mistake he had made. And all the color seemed to drain from his face. And he said in one hurried breath, I'm terribly sorry for the misunderstanding. My name is Steve, if you want to report me. And then he ran for the door. Well, I felt bad for Steve. This was a reasonable mistake. And so I tried to chase after him to tell him, no worries, it's okay. But alas, Steve was too fast. So from that moment forward, I looked out for Steve. Every time I saw Steve on the floor, in the hallway, in the tunnel, going between the Senate office buildings and the Capitol, I'd say, hi, Steve, and I'd wave and I'd smile, just so he knew that we were friends, and it was cool. And then one day it occurred to me, his name's probably not Steve. For all I know, it's Bob. Steve's a guy he works with he doesn't like, but I reflect on that story from time to time for a number of reasons. One of them being that I had to do something uncomfortable that day. My parents used to tell me when I was a kid that doing things that take you out of your comfort zone, that make you a little uncomfortable, it's good for you. And it's the kind of advice you always hate receiving as a kid. But it's kind of true. But it reminds me of a deeper truth that sometimes we have to assert our right to do certain things, to be certain places. In a sense, I had to assert my right to be there that day, even though it made me uncomfortable. Because if I had failed to do so, I would have been deprived of something that I was there to do. Had I not been willing to assert my right to be there, I might have found myself getting hauled off, perhaps in handcuffs with some of my colleagues, waiting a little bit longer before telling them he actually has a right to be here. I wouldn't have been able to vote that day. The 3 million people I represent in Utah, not all of whom are related to me, anytime you can introduce a polygamy-related joke as a Utah politician, it's always fun. When I got there, by the way, I had two cousins in the U.S. Senate, two second cousins, both Democrats, but I felt the need to point out to my colleagues, this was accomplished without polygamy. This was not a... when you have to assert your right to be somewhere or do something, it means something different. It means something more than it would otherwise mean. Had I not asserted my right to be there that day, I wouldn't have been able to cast that vote. And all of us, as citizens, have something like this. Now, a number of you are judges. Some of you are lawmakers or public officials of one sort or another. But regardless of what you do, whether you hold public office or not, whether you cast votes regularly or not, if you're here on U.S. soil, if you are a U.S. citizen, you have certain rights, certain things that are yours, things that have to be asserted, just like I had to assert my right to be there that day. And those things which you have to assert in order for them to be meaningful can be lost. They can be neglected. And as they're not lost and neglected, they can atrophy and they can cease to become meaningful. What I'm referring to here, what I think about when I say those words, I'm not talking about our more obvious constitutional protections, those things that are widely recognized, widely followed, and routinely observed. I'm not talking about your protection against self-incrimination. I'm not talking about your Miranda rights or anything like that. I'm talking about some of our subtler constitutional protections that have become neglected. And I'm thinking about two of them in particular that we as a people have neglected, or in many cases our elected officials have neglected on our behalf over a long period of time. And what I think about are the structural protections of the Constitution, which I believe are as important as any other feature of the Constitution itself, as important as any substantive protection in the Constitution, any substantive limitation, are the two structural components of the Constitution that separate power, that restrict power, that limit power in a structural way. And, you know, the whole point of the Constitution, of having a Constitution, is to limit government power. And the main objective of our founding fathers was to protect the people against the dangers associated with the excessive accumulation of power in the hands of the few. They had learned through sad experience that bad things happen when you allow any one person or one group of people to get too much power. And so they split up power along two axes in the Constitution, along the vertical axis with something we call federalism, along the horizontal axis with something we call separation of powers. And yet we have drifted from both of those protections over the last 80 years. It's significant, I think, that it's happened in tandem. It's happened at the same time. In other words, I can trace our drift away from federalism and separation of powers to a distinct moment in some respects. Some of you may disagree with me on this, but hear me out. April 12, 1937. That was a date that forever changed the Constitution, or that has changed the Constitution over the last 80 years in a very significant way. It was a day the Constitution was changed without an amendment being ratified. It was a day that the Constitution changed by virtue of the Supreme Court's ruling in a case called NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steele. That, of course, was the case that gave us the standard that became memorialized 5 years later in Wickard versus Filburn. The substantial effects case under the Commerce Clause. I see some young lawyers and law students nodding eagerly. I'm glad that case thrills you as it does me. Thrills you in a horrifying way. In my small town of Alpine, Utah, we speak of little else. On that day, the Supreme Court changed our system of federalism. It weakened federalism. We ceased to be a country with the federal government that had powers that James Madison described as few and defined, with those powers being reserved to the states being described as numerous and indefinite. Because a federal government that can regulate any and every activity that, when measured in the aggregate, has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, we're recognizing a basically all-purpose national government exercising what we might call general police powers. This, in turn, set the stage for the elimination of the horizontal protection of separation of powers. Those two, for whatever reason, the laws of thermodynamics have a corollary in government, that when you obliterate the vertical structural protection of the Constitution, you're setting the table for the weakening of the horizontal structural protection. Because ever since that date, on April 12, 1937, you've seen more and more power given to the federal government. As that power is taken away from the people and moved to Washington, the people's elected representatives, the senators and congressmen in Washington, whose job it is to make law, all of a sudden see the power as so vast, so unmanageable, that they have to delegate the one thing they're there to do, which is to make federal law, over to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. It becomes overwhelming. Managing the affairs of an entire country, as they are increasingly inclined to do, rather than just passing laws, becomes unbearable. So instead of making actual laws, we pass broad platitudinal statements, like, we shall have clean air. What idiot's going to vote against that? We shall have clean air, and we hereby delegate to the EPA the task of defining the term clean air, of deciding what clean air means, deciding what pollution is, and what are acceptable levels of pollution, deciding what industries or what actors within which industries are going to be responsible for cleaning up the air, setting penalties, and then enforcing those same penalties. So you have executive branch bureaucrats who become at once lawmaker and interpreter, judge, and enforcer, all within the cozy confines of one executive branch agency. Now, these are smart people who do this. They are well-educated, they're well-intentioned, they're hard-working, they're highly specialized, but there's one critical distinction between them and the people who are supposed to be making the laws. They don't work for you. You can't fire them. You can fire people like me every 6 years. You can fire my counterparts in the House every 2 years. You cannot fire executive branch bureaucrats. They're almost untouchable. So as a result, you, the citizen, are insulated from the lawmaking process. Now, lest any of us delude ourselves into thinking that this is a de minimis problem, that this is a highly technical problem, Think again. I explained some of this in a book I wrote a couple years ago called Our Lost Constitution. Somebody here today bought some copies of that, and I was just thrilled to hear it. All 12 people who have read Our Lost Constitution have loved it. Although it's not 12. Yesterday I met number 13. Judge Gorsuch was in my office. We're going to talk about Judge Gorsuch a little bit later. I gave him a signed copy of Our Lost Constitution, and he made my day, week, month, year, and decade when he said, "I've already read that book." And I felt like the little kid in the Coke commercial circa 1981 when Mean Joe Green throws him his jersey. "Thanks, Mean Joe Green." It was the best moment of my life. I had to call my wife, Sharon, and say, "Oh, you're not going to believe this." In my office, as I explain in Our Lost Constitution, I keep these two stacks of documents to remind me of this problem, to remind me of the fact that this is not just a de minimis problem. One stack of documents is a few inches tall. It's a few thousand pages long, most years 2,000, 3,000 at the most, and it consists of the laws passed by Congress last year. The other stack of documents is 12 feet tall. This year, it's 97,000 pages long, and it consists of last year's Federal Register. Both sets of documents contain legally binding norms, obligations, enforceable with the overwhelming power of the federal government. But the small stack is put in place by elected officials who you can fire. The large stack is put in place by people who were at once judge, jury, and executioner, who are insulated from the political process, who carry with them most of the powers that historically we would have aligned, we would have associated with despotism. And yet we have done this because we're told over and over again, the federal government is wise. The federal government will not let you down. We've attributed to the federal government powers that it doesn't have, that no mortal can have. We've have at times almost associated with the federal government these characteristics of omniscience and omnipotence that we should never attribute to another mortal human being. And yet as we do this, we're creating a complexity within the federal government that insulates the people. It ends up hurting those who we should most be helping. And by that, I mean America's poor and middle class. Consider the fact that when I was in law school 20 years ago, I first learned of the problem associated with the cost of federal regulations and how that cost is paid and the complexity of how that cost is passed downstream. I was very alarmed when I discovered during a lecture in law school that our federal regulatory system was costing the American economy $300 billion a year, an enormous amount of money, and that by complying with federal regulations, people who make things or do things to help other people end up having to increase the prices they charge on those things that they make, on those services that they provide. The overwhelming majority of those costs end up getting paid for by the little guy, by John Q. and Susie M. Public. I don't know why it's Susie M. Public rather than John Q. Susie Q. Public, but never mind that. They end up paying for those regulatory costs through diminished wages, unemployment, underemployment, and most importantly, higher prices on goods and services, every single thing that they buy. This, our guest lecturer explained to us, has the effect of a backdoor invisible tax that is highly regressive, that disproportionately affects America's poor and middle class. This, he explained, is unacceptable. This, he explained, is incompatible with federalism and separation of powers. And this, he explained, we've got to turn around because America's poor and middle class can't take much more of this. Fast forward two decades, that $300 billion annual compliance cost is now up to $2 trillion. This is really hurting people. It's hurting almost all Americans, except that we have to remember that complexity in our law is itself a kind of subsidy. There are some people who benefit from this. It's just they're not the people who need the most help. The complexity in our legal system and the detachment, the insulation between most of the people affected by the law and the people who make and interpret and enforce the law disproportionately affects those with certain types of skills, and especially those who live in a certain part of the country. Here's an interesting data point. 6 of our nation's 10 wealthiest counties are suburbs of Washington, D.C. This is an area that manufactures nothing. This is an area that is not home to any technological innovation hub. It's not a banking mecca. No, the money is there only because the power is there. Embedded and enmeshed in the society that surrounds the Beltway, concentrated in the hands of a few elites, all of whom benefit as a result of the complexity that's focused around that city. And all of that, in turn, is rooted in our neglect, our chronic neglect, of federalism and separation of powers. This was the great bargain that was struck. This was the great compromise that was there as an economic document of sorts to make sure that America's poor and middle class could always find a path toward upward mobility, because this was a place where you'd be rewarded based on your efforts rather than based on your connection to the government, rather than based, like it was in the old world, on whatever dispensation you were provided by a king. So we've neglected it. We have to restore it. Just as this slide started, I believe, with the neglect of federalism, and just as the neglect of federalism led to a neglect of separation of powers, I think we have to start by restoring federalism, by returning to that same list of powers that the Founding Fathers outlined in Article 1, Section 8, which describes basically every power we are supposed to have in Washington, D.C., the power to coin money, to declare war, to provide for our national defense, to coin money and regulate the value thereof, to provide for laws governing bankruptcy, immigration, and naturalization, regulating trade or commerce between the states with foreign nations and with Indian tribes. And then there's my favorite power of Congress, a power we don't talk about enough, the power to grant letters of marque and reprisal. And for those of you not lucky enough to know what this power is, today's your lucky day, because you're going to find out. The letter of marque and reprisal is, of course, basically a hall pass issued by Congress that enables the holder, in the name of the United States, to engage in acts of piracy on the high seas with impunity. You know it, Jesse. I don't know how long I'm going to serve in the U.S. Senate, but regardless of how long, someday I'm going to get a letter of marque and reprisal. I'm going to be a pirate, and Jesse's going to join me. By the way, you did really well in that interview. These powers are, in fact, few and defined, and those reserved to the states are, in fact, numerous and indefinite. It was the political branches that caused the Supreme Court on that day to get to that point. I believe it has to be the political branches that move it back. And so that's why my dream, my goal, my vision is to help the Federalist Society. First of all, in putting all this together, I want to emphasize the great extent to which the Federalist Society is the answer to so much of what we face as a country. The Federalist Society has done so much over the last 35 years to change the way not just lawyers and judges and legal scholars look at the law and the Constitution, but it's had a spillover effect onto the American people. You, we, it, the Federalist Society, and all associated with it have reinvigorated a constitutional discussion that has needed to happen. It's now common for people to talk about textualism and originalism in a way that it wasn't common before. It's now, in fact, considered the norm when someone wants to be interviewed, whether by a judicial nominating commission or a governor or a combination of the two, for people to walk in and say, when interpreting the text, we read the text. When interpreting the text is what matters. The expression of what the legislature intended to do is itself the text. That was not common 30, 40 years ago. In fact, it almost never happened. The Federalist Society is responsible for that. And I believe the Federalist Society also holds the keys to the next chapter of this change, this great change that is taking place, because this is now having a spillover effect into the political branches of government, where people are running for Congress, believe it or not, as textualist originalists, not necessarily using that as a retail phrase in politics, but nonetheless making arguments that we, as members of the Federalist Society, would recognize. The Federal Society is also making a difference by grooming a new generation of lawyers, law students, scholars, judges, and yes, future Supreme Court justices. The fact that we've gotten to where we are now, where Antonin Scalia is about to be replaced by Neil Gorsuch, a judge before whom I've had the privilege of arguing and in whom I have great confidence, is itself a credit to the Federalist Society, to efforts from people like Jonathan Bunch and Leonard Leo, who have worked so long, so hard to try to build great chapters around the country, like the chapters we have all over the state of Florida and statewide in the state of Florida. I want to reserve a few minutes of time to take questions, but before I close, I want to make a promise to you. We are going to confirm Judge Gorsuch, and Judge Gorsuch will be the next Supreme Court justice. I promise you that. He will, I believe, comport himself the same way on the Supreme Court as he has on the Tenth Circuit, which is an extraordinarily good thing. I've spent an enormous amount of time in recent days reading Gorsuch, just reading every opinion I can find, every opinion I can get my hands on, everything else that he's written that I can get my hands on, and I've had a huge smile on my face as I've read it. It's enjoyable, and it is the kind of writing that reminds all of us about the limited nature of the federal government, about the importance of separation of powers, and the necessarily limited and defined role of the federal judiciary. This is the kind of jurist we want on the Supreme Court, and we're going to confirm him. So it's my hope and my expectation that we, as a group of lawyers who share a passion for limited government, for better government, can stand up and even when, especially when it's difficult, reassert that which is rightfully ours. We are, after all, US citizens. Living in a country where there is a limited purpose federal government, with powers limited along a vertical axis with federalism and along a horizontal axis with separation of powers, is in fact our birthright. We can reclaim it. We can restore it. But we have to start asserting it, not just in our careers as lawyers, but as citizens. We've got to start talking to our friends, our neighbors, our family members, our uncles and aunts, even the really crazy ones. Sometimes they're the easiest ones to convince. Sometimes they're the hardest. You never really know. Feel free to share with them the idea of letters of mark and reprisal. Sometimes that's appealing to the crazy ones. As we do that, and as we reinvigorate the Constitution as the most basic fundamental component of our national political discourse, we can restore constitutionally limited government and the blessings of liberty, of freedom, and upward mobility that come along with it. We can, we must, and together we will. Thank you very much.
Senator Lee, first a comment. I want to thank you for your service, and also thank you, as I did last night, for your father's service. He was, for those of you who don't know, Senator Lee's father was Ronald Reagan's first Solicitor General and a mentor to many young conservatives. I don't know if I should say he was a mentor to me, because that may have been an insult to Solicitor General Lee, but I considered him a mentor and a friend, so thank you for that. On your comment about bureaucrats, having worked in the federal government, I get the sense it's really not the career bureaucrats. They don't really get to do things without the approval of their superiors. So Isn't there a problem with even under Reagan and Bush coming in and the Schedule Cs and the PASs sort of getting captured by the agencies?
Yeah. Look, there is no question that this is not all done either by the lower-level bureaucrats or the high-level political appointees acting alone. And in fact, to isolate it to any one person or one group of people is to make the same mistake that got us into this mess to begin with. The problem is actually Congress, because without Congress deliberately delegating this power, none of this would happen. It does take both. It takes the low-level bureaucrats and the high-level bureaucrats along with the high-level political appointees to make this mess. But at the heart of it is Congress's unwillingness to put on its mantle of lawmaking power and actually own it. And as I explained in our last constitution, this is not an accident. Members of Congress like to point to the Federal Register when I point out this example. They'll like to point to the Federal Register and say, yeah, isn't that awful, those barbarians? You know, speaking of it as if we were victims. We're not the victims, we're the perpetrators. We're the ones who did this because it's for the sake of political expediency of members of Congress that this happens. It's a way for us to have have all the credit and none of the blame for trying to solve problems in society. One of the favorite stories I tell in our lost constitution it involves a couple of lawmakers, federal lawmakers who were involved in the passage of the Clean Air Act, who then led a protest against some of the regulations promulgated pursuant to the Clean Air Act just a few years later, forgetting, of course, that they themselves had delegated this power. So anyway, that's the problem. The way we start to clean it up is by passing things like the RAINS Act, which would require Congress affirmatively to pass major rules before they take effect, and the Separation of Powers Restoration Act, which I introduced last year, which would get rid of Chevron deference. It's the one audience in America where I can talk about Chevron deference and it brings applause.
Senator Lee, thank you so much for coming to our little event here. I was really concerned a couple of years ago when the Democrats used the nuclear option to stamp out dissent on lower court nominees, and I would be just as horrified if the Republican-controlled Senate did that now. Do you get the sense that that will be necessary, or do you think that a bipartisan effort to confirm Judge Gorsuch will happen?
The short answer to your question is I don't know. I don't know because we don't yet know all the moving parts behind this. We don't yet know for sure whether it will be filibustered. A couple of my colleagues have said they would. It really only takes one to filibuster, thus requiring us to get 60 votes to end debate. But we're not certain of that. We are not certain, number two, whether we'll be able to get to 60. I think it's entirely possible that we could get to 60, and that would foreclose any opportunity even to go nuclear there. The third step is even assuming they filibuster him and we can't get to 60, that still doesn't necessarily mean that we have to use the nuclear option. There is something called Rule 19 that imposes a two-speech rule, meaning we can, under the existing rules of the Senate, stay in the same legislative day, and while we stay in the same legislative day, which in 1980 was done for six continuous months, quite a feat, you can limit to two speeches the number of times that an individual senator may speak on that topic. Once every senator wishing to speak on that topic has exhausted his or her right to do so, you move directly to the final confirmation vote, and there is no cloture. If we followed that path, we wouldn't even have to go down the nuclear path. I do want to say, though, if for some reason it does come to that, it is important to remember the Democrats nuked the filibuster on the executive calendar. I don't know whether it will have to come to that. I hope it doesn't have to come to that. But they nuked it already, meaning they broke the rules to change the rules. They claimed that it would not apply and did not apply on that portion of the executive calendar dealing with Supreme Court nominees. That, in my opinion, is the legislative equivalent of the rankest form of dicta. Dicta not essential to the holding of the case and therefore not binding in other cases, so for whatever that's worth. I don't know whether the parliamentarian will see it that way, but.
Thank you, Senator. I was wondering, can you take us through a little bit of the detail about how congressional interviews with potential judges go when they come? What types of questions you ask? Are there any more pragmatic life experience questions that you ask to get to what type of judge they're going to be? I can think of one example. One of the reasons I think that we get poor Second Amendment decisions, even from judges who philosophically you would expect to get to the right answer, is because, you know, if a judge has no idea how a firearm works, might not realize how asinine an assault weapons ban is that doesn't target lethality and targets, you know, cosmetic features. So one of the questions I might ask is, you know, what's your experience with firearms? Can you just go through how, you know, the substance of those congressional interviews and what you like to ask?
That's a great question. Last week, I saw Kellyanne Conway on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, and he was talking to her about, you know, the upcoming nomination, which was about to be made, and how contentious it was going to be. And Kellyanne Conway said, you know, we know where a lot of the questions are going to go. The senators are not going to be interested in asking the nominee how he or she feels about the Commerce Clause. And I thought, that's my cue. I immediately texted her and I said, Kellyanne, number one, great job on Fox News Sunday. Number two, I ask every single judicial nominee I talk to about the Commerce Clause. So I did. We talked to Judge Gorsuch about that the other day. I did not ask him about the components of firearms or what experience he had had with it. That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question that I suspect I or other senators might ask him at some point. I do try, as a general matter, to ask questions that are designed not to focus on any one particular area, but to ask questions that that paint as broadly as possible, simply so I can see how the judge thinks. I tend to ask questions about how they view certain broad constitutional principles. I think with a Supreme Court nominee, it's important to ask questions about finding a delicate balance between, on the one hand, the need to decide the case at hand, and on the other hand, figuring out what effect you're going to have elsewhere and how broadly you should write based on the need to not unduly influence cases involving facts not before the court. Anyone else? You can ask me about law, politics, gardening, fashion, relationships, rock music lyrics from the 1970s and 80s. All those things are on the table. We've got one over here.
I think a lot of particular Republicans, if their litmus test for this Congress is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, we heard, you know, you had to get the House. Well, that didn't work. Then you had to get the Senate. Then you had to get the President. We've got those. Now, in recent few days, we've been hearing that part of it can be done through the reconciliation process, and part of it can't. But some of us remember, at least, but we're not experts on this, that it was passed through the reconciliation process. So you could update us on all that?
Yes. Yes, I will. I just remembered something else that I should have said in response to the other question. Let me hit that first, and then I'm going to go to this. I almost forgot to tell you the most important part. I was talking to my wife, Sharon. Whenever I have a profound thought, it's normally there are normally pretty good odds that it came from Sharon in one form or another. She and I were talking about this, and it occurred to her, and it makes sense to me, that there will end up being three buckets of questions that end up getting asked of the nominee. In the first bucket, you will have questions that are all about the senator asking the question and wanting to grandstand, sound smart, sound assertive, or make a political argument. The second bucket of questions will involve an attempt to communicate from one senator to another, shots across the bow. In the third bucket, you'll have questions that actually deal with the nominee himself and deal with the nominee's eminent qualifications for the office. I hope to focus on those questions. With respect to your question about the Affordable Care Act, we are determined to repeal Obamacare in its entirety, to uproot it lock, stock, and barrel. We are certain that we can repeal nearly all of it using the reconciliation procedure. For those of you not burdened with the knowledge of Senate parlance, budget reconciliation refers to a process whereby we can bring debate to a close on a piece of legislation that is sufficiently budgetary that it can be considered part of the budget process and that it can be passed with only 51 votes without the need to bring debate to a close with 60 votes. There are three main components of Obamacare. There are the taxes, there are the subsidies, and there are the insurance regulations, minimum essential health coverage benefits, the individual mandate, things like that, things that regulate the insurance industry. The first two categories can be covered entirely with reconciliation. There are some features of the insurance regulation part of Obamacare where there's doubt as to how much we can repeal using reconciliation and therefore repeal with 51 votes in the Senate. We think we can get to much or most of, actually most of Obamacare, and there is even a lot in that third category of the insurance regulations. The Obamacare reconciliation repeal bill that both houses of Congress passed in December of 2015 hit most of that. Initially, we were being told, no, there's not very much of it we can get. And they ran a bill initially in the House of Representatives that would have repealed a fairly small portion of Obamacare. But fortunately, there were enough of us who were willing to voice opposition to that that we were able to get most of Obamacare in there. I think we're going to end up with something that looks a lot like the December 2015 repeal bill, which means the overwhelming majority of Obamacare will be repealed. But I've set that as my minimum. That has to be the floor rather than the ceiling of what we will repeal. We will see that get done within the next few months, and fortunately we now have a president who will sign rather than veto that legislation. And before I leave the Obamacare topic, I want to make one thing very clear. And I hope each of you will help me to echo this message if you agree with it, which I hope you do. The very worst thing we could do right now as a newly reelected Republican Congress with a newly elected Republican president is to take Obamacare, chop it up, and repackage it in new packaging and slap a cute little Republican elephant label on it and hand it back to the people and say, there you go. It's Obamacare 2.0. It's Republican Obamacare. We'll call it, I don't know. Well, never mind. I'm not going to do that to any of my colleagues. I was going to say we'll call it Cruz Care, Rubio Care, Lee Care. Let's not do that. Republican Care. That's the very worst thing we could do. I am worried. The reason I raise this is because there are those in Washington, some Republican members of Congress and some who have their ear, who are actually making this argument. In one form or another, they're saying, let's keep this process. Let's maintain a heavy federal regulatory tax and subsidy role in the health insurance industry. My response to that is absolutely crazy. It is hubristic of us to think that the only reason Obamacare failed was because the people who wrote it were Democrats. No, no, no. It failed because this is the kind of thing that will always fail. You take 1/6 of the nation's economy and you put it in control of the federal government, you're going to destroy it. And you're going to hurt people. You're going to hurt a lot of people, especially America's middle class, who have been rendered unable to afford Obamacare. So when you hear Republicans talk about how, oh, we're going to replace it with our own Republican version of this, with our own Republican taxes, subsidies, and hefty federal insurance regulations, please push back on them. The very best thing we can do to repeal and replace Obamacare is to repeal and return this authority back to where it belongs, which is with the states. Let the states decide for themselves how they want to regulate health insurance. Let the states themselves decide whether to what extent they want to sponsor health coverage within their own state. I have it on good authority that most of the people in Vermont would prefer a single-payer, government-run, government-funded healthcare system. Let them not knock themselves out. One of the reasons I'll never live in Vermont. But what works in Vermont isn't necessarily going to work in Utah. And let's let each state decide for itself how it wants to do things. That's what has made America great in the past, and it's the only path toward making America great again. Thank you very much.